I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Cat Waters at PRN.FM. Hello. Our phone number here, 888-874-4888. That's a free call, 888-874-4888. If you want to join us, we're going to be joined in a few minutes by really one of the gutsy Jewish leaders and rabbis in the world, really, Michael Lerner, based in on the West Coast. He's going to be joining us. We're going to be talking about a whole range of issues. We missed each other the last time out, so I wanted to get him back on the air, and he agreed, I'm happy to say. And so here we are with Michael Lerner in a minute. But first, I just wanted to bring you up to date on a few things about what's going on that you'd find interesting. I spent the morning down at NYU, where Tom Hayden, the SDS leader from the 1960s, was talking about the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, which was the statement that was really the statement of student activism in the early 60s, declaring what students wanted, what we needed, and putting forth a program. It was over 100 pages long. Interesting. The core idea of it is called participatory democracy. And on September 17th last year, when Occupy began, they also used that term in their founding documents. That was one of their goals, participatory democracy. So ideas have a way of carrying on. Hayden was quite brilliant in recounting how that whole thing happened, the various debates they had, including two interesting issues. One, their refusal to make anti-communism a core tenet of the Port Huron Statement, and as a result, lost the support of the organization that they were working with, the League for Industrial Democracy. And Hayden suggested that CIA funding was part of the problem, that they basically were funding the organization that they were part of, and they had to, as part of their, you know, basic credentials with that organization, to support or to bang on, you know, the Soviet Union, communism is bad, blah, 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 the whole Cold War theme, when the whole document said we want to end the Cold War. So he recounted a trial, essentially, that the SDS people went through when they were grilled about their credentials, until the locks were changed on their office suddenly one day, and they were ousted and thrown out in the street because of their principles, because they believed that they were not going to be part of this whole Cold War anymore. And Hayden spoke about that and how shocking it was to him. I raised the question, also interesting, in terms of Occupy, if anybody's wants to contribute on this. We can talk about it a little later. But Adbusters has just released a communique denouncing, you know, the people who are not into every aspect of Occupy Wall Street. And they're attacking and conflating the cops, the media, and sort of Ben and Jerry. It's all part of one thing, and move on, you know, all trying to, it's a strategy, a counter strategy to destroy Occupy, say they. And moreover, they say they're in a fight to the finish against, you know, these tendencies that may not have embraced so-called horizontalism. So here, too, we have an outbreak of an ugly sectarian dispute in Occupy Wall Street. I write about it today in my blog at newsdissector.net if you want to read the full text of what Adbusters had to say and my comments on it. But, you know, certain issues and certain political styles seem to go on over the decades, over the generations, and continue to be with us. And something that Michael Lerner, who will be with us in a minute, knows quite a bit about. Also today, I wanted to just comment on the great reception we had last night at the Anarchist Film Festival, and there's going to showing my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. There was a great turnout, and Priya Reddy helped organize it, did a great job, and the Anarchist Film Festival resumes today. Do you want to tell us where?
Yeah, it's going to be 3 p.m. today at what is formerly known as In Studios, but they call it now the Epifano Cafe at 56 Walker Street. It starts at 3. It goes until at least 10, or 11 p.m., and there's just going to be a lot of clips, a lot of actual footage on revolutions and, you know, the history of, you know, people's rising up.
So that's something to check out. 56 Walker Street is in Tribeca here in New York City. Check it out if you can. Okay, folks, get ready. Time for News Dissector Radio.
In the entire planet that are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
This is corrupt! Something's
wrong! Something's wrong in America!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game.
This is corrupt!
Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
Something's Wrong in America. That's from the Occupy collage song put together by Polarity One, Polar Levine, and shared with us here as part of an Occupy radio program. It's high energy, like so many people in Occupy are. Michael Lerner is someone that I've known over the years as somebody who's really made a sincere transition from just a political activist to a spiritual activist, the founder and editor and one of the members of the Tikkun magazine collective, a rabbi who is really outspoken on the Israel-Palestine issues, and somebody who has also been attacked quite viciously by the right wing in Israel and their supporters in this country, challenged his right to speak being challenged, his house actually attacked at one point. You know, and he's been very gutsy and unwavering in his ideas. And Michael, I'm so pleased you could join us today on our program.
Thank you so much.
You know, we're at a time right now, I mean, just politically, I mean, you've seen the Occupy movement, you know, and every day you read the papers and, you know, here's an article, the lead article in the New York Times today, campaigns plan maximum push to raise money. Goal of $600 million for Romney, Obama aiming for more. This is the complete takeover of our democracy by money. In many cases, these super PACs are only reflecting input and contributions, donations from a handful of people. So you have a very small elite of an elite, you know, kind of the 0.0001% of the 1% who are actually financing all of this. And this does not augur well, as far as I can see, for a real democracy in America.
You know, our organization from Tikkun magazine that we've created called the Interfaith Network of Spiritual Progressives, which you can find on the web at spiritualprogressives.org, has launched a campaign for what we call in the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And one of the planks of the ESRA, the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution, is that that it requires that there be no private money in any national or state elections, and that the elections will be solely and totally financed by public funds from the government, and that all media, our major media, are required to give equal and free time to major candidates in any election, and that every corporation in America with incomes of over $100 million a year must get a new corporate charter once every 5 years. And that new corporate charter will only be granted to those corporations that can prove a satisfactory history of social and environmental responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens.
Well, I mean, Michael, let me just jump in here. I mean, you know, this is a core issue in our democracy. There are many people, certainly here in the Occupy movement, maybe Catherine can speak to this, who have been, she's an occupier and is occupying my radio show every week. She has been part of this whole debate about money in politics and getting money out of politics. And it seems like what you're codifying or proposing here gives a hook for people to focus on that might be really quite important, because we're gradually losing, you know, what control we might have had over our democracy as these big money interests no longer sort of play on the sidelines. They're like in the main ring here. They're dominating the whole show.
Exactly. And I think that the left has taken a wrong turn by focusing only on overcoming the Citizens United decision of 2010, because it would take a constitutional amendment to overcome that. And if you're going to do a constitutional amendment, which is a huge project, then you ought to use it in the way that the ERA was so effective, namely in raising consciousness by putting forward a different vision of what you are really for. And we're not really for going back to 2010 just before the Supreme Court's decision, because the Supreme Court's decision only codified one aspect of money dominating politics. But the fact is that corporations are not the only way that you can get money into politics. And so the rich people are able to donate to all kinds of funds that are used then to give them the power over who's going to win an election.
You know, what's interesting about this, Michael, also as I indicated before, you know, that this whole trend, $600 million for Romney, Obama aiming for more. The other slug, if you will, in the headline here on the New York Times, public funds unlikely. These goals make it virtually certain that neither party's nominee will accept public funds for the general election or the spending limits that come with them. The likely death knell.
That's why the ESRA simply bans all of these private funds.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying this is a death knell for a cornerstone of the post-Watergate campaign finance reforms intended to limit the influence of money in federal elections. So,
and as long as we have this Supreme Court, it's foolish to think that any piece of legislation is going to stand up that would change this. So the only way because we've got the Supreme Court dominated by right-wingers, in part because liberal Democrats voted for these right-wing candidates to be put on the Supreme Court, thinking, oh, we'll show how nonpartisan we are.
Right, fair and reasonable.
Crazy.
Catherine, you wanted to comment on this money issue?
I heard you speak at the Riverside Church for Occupy the Mind.
Yes.
And I thought it was incredible. The speakers that were there were incredible. I mean, you in particular did stand out for me. I wasn't, familiar with you up until then. And I was really, agreed with like so much of what you were saying, just about people and how they have to, treat each other better. But I wanted to add, the next time you get, to the East Coast, you're invited to come to the working group ending corporate personhood that I, attend. We have weekly meetings at 60 Wall Street so far it's on Wednesdays at about 7 p.m. And they discuss a lot of the things that you were just mentioning.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's great. And I love talking at there. I was talking about not only Israel-Palestine, which is the subject of my current book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, but also about the fundamental need in our country for a new bottom line. Because right now, the bottom line, when institutions, when corporations, when government policies, when our legal system, our healthcare system, our educational system are looked at, the bottom line is, how does this contribute to money and to the maximization of money and power? And so institutions are judged efficient, rational, and productive if they can show that they are producing either money or power for somebody, usually people on the top. And what we're saying in our network of spiritual progressives, and this has been an idea developed in Tikkun magazine, by the way, it's TIKKUN tikkun.org, that you can go there, tikkun.org, and read some of our articles, that what we've been saying is we need a new bottom line in which institutions and social practices, corporations, government policies, et cetera, are judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, the old bottom line, but also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacity to respond to the universe with awe, wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of all that is, rather than look at the universe and say, gee, I wonder how we can turn this into a commodity to sell it on the capitalist marketplace.
All right, we'd like to say, yeah. Just take a pause, Michael, for a second. Go. We want to say a little amen, Dayenu. Well said, well spoken. Clearly,
applause.
But I think what's important is that there's some vision here, that there's some, not just reacting to a problem, but talking about what we really want and need and how to get there. This is something that, you know, it's much easier to be in opposition, to attack, you know, the other guy, rather than to enunciate what it is you believe in and then talk about how to get there. And I think, you know, the magazine has done a great job over the years raising these issues, and so have you. And I'm very concerned that this not be lost. I mean, I've focused more on the other side, maybe as an investigative reporter, as a media critic, analyzing, challenging, et cetera, and so forth. But this other dimension has been with me as well. And one of the issues that I think is extremely important that I wanted to spend some time on is this whole situation of what's happened in, Israel today and what the prospects of war are with Iran. What is the actual situation in Israel? Because on the one hand, we've seen Israel had one of the biggest Occupy movements against their economy. Also, it also has done more occupying of other people's lands than almost anyone else.
Well, let me say, first of all, before getting into that, that your work over the years, over the decades, has been wonderful, Danny. And you've made a great contribution to the development of a new consciousness in America, both in your reporting and in just the way that you talk about the world. So I want to congratulate you for a long history of being out there and telling the truth and bringing the truth to people in all the different forms of media that you've worked.
Well, that's very nice. It's good to be blessed by a rabbi, particularly, you know, Erev Yontif, Erev Shabbat, you know. I appreciate
so
that.
Back to your question.
Let's go back, though, to...
There are many who think that the all this talk about an attack on Iran is just so much bluster. It's psychological warfare that is being done for the sake of getting Iran to take the moves that the United States wants it to take to end the development or to make sure that it doesn't develop nuclear weapons. On the other hand, I think that view underestimates the craziness, the political craziness that exists in Israel, in which people, the more extreme they get, the more support they get. There is in Israel a definite need for a new bottom line and a new way of looking at the other. Although I don't believe that it's only Israel. I think that both Israel and Palestinians need to learn to see the other as equally embodiments of the spirit of God, or if you're a secular person, to say equally deserving of respect and caring. And I don't believe that struggle is ever going to be over until both sides are able to recognize the humanity and fundamental decency of the other.
What stands in the way to them? You've been in so many different conferences, both in Israel and in the United States. You've been in debates back and forth. You know, when you were talking about attitudes, you know, I kept thinking of a phrase, MF, which in this case means the Meshuggah effect, you know, that you have, people who are extremely self-righteous, extremely uninformed, but committed to formulas and slogans that have terrible implications for the world.
Yes, you're totally right. However, In my book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, this new book that has just come out and which you can get from Kindle in that form, or you can get it at Amazon.com, or you can get your local local bookstore to carry it, Embracing Israel-Palestine, I argue that there's also and needs to be taken into account the post-traumatic stress disorder that both peoples face. The Israeli and Jewish people around the world, from the fact that in my lifetime, one out of every three Jews alive on the planet was murdered. One out of every three Jews alive on the planet was murdered. And on the other hand, the Palestinian people facing the Nakba, the great catastrophe that happened when, during the creation of the State of Israel, some 800,000 Palestinians either fled, some of them, or were forced out, a lot of them, from Israel during that war, and then not allowed to return to their homes after the war, created a tremendous trauma which has been passed on from generation to generation of Palestinians. And both sides can't be looked at solely from the standpoint of how evil their ideas are. We have to also understand the tremendous traumatic reality that they embody that keeps them from acting in their own best rational self-interest. Now, get that leads me to say, well, how are we going to move to change that consciousness? And that is going to require a change not just in Israel-Palestine, but in the Western countries as well. Because as long as we hold on to the view that homeland security can best be achieved by domination and control over the other, I think that worldview becomes the common sense of everybody in this society, and then people in Israel who say, no, let's go for a different relationship to the Palestinian people, are viewed as naive and utopian. So what we are arguing for in Tikkun and the Network of Spiritual Progressives is a new strategy, a replacement of the strategy of domination, that homeland security comes through domination and control over others, to a strategy of generosity that says that the way to achieve homeland security, the best way, is to treat other people in a spirit of generosity and genuine caring about the well-being of all. And we believe that is not only necessary to end the struggle in the Middle East, but it's also necessary for a much deeper reason, because the United States and the Western world are facing a global environmental crisis that is likely to destroy human life on this planet within the next 100 years.
Rabbi.
And that will not be eliminated until all people can recognize that our well-being as Americans or Israelis or Palestinians or Chinese or Japanese or Indians or Russians or whatever depends on the well-being of everyone else on the planet. That is, we've got to overcome this crazy nationalism and develop a sense of the human rights and our commitment to the human race.
Right. Well, Michael, you know, I think we have to include the people of Brooklyn in this as well.
Really?
The People's Republic of Brooklyn, of which Catherine is now representing. You wanted to throw in an idea here.
Oh, no, Rabbi Lerner, I totally, high-five everything that you're saying. I mean, because what you are saying right now, you're talking completely about a different kind of deficit. It's like a mental or emotional deficit. And I think about, California, and when it gets so hot and so dry that just brush fires break out, like that's what you're talking about. I mean,
yes.
And it's once. I mean, I study alternative healing and health and massage and everything. And yeah. It's once, oxygen deprivation sets in to the muscle, it's right, debt just perpetuates itself. And once people get into a psychological deficit, it's just going to keep perpetuating itself until it gets some kind of lubrication and some moisture.
Yeah,
okay, well, kid.
One of the problems with the liberal and progressive forces, that we talk in terms of specific policies, but we rarely talk about the underlying values. And we're ashamed, even embarrassed, to talk about love, kindness, generosity. We think that makes us look weak.
Oh, it's right. We live in a totally homophobic, like even a crumb of, like, heaven forbid, gentleness or femininity makes you like a, you know, queer or something.
Can I break into this love fest for a second here? not that I disagree, but I'm just saying, I think that there's not a lot of awareness. Okay, when people talk about Israel in the United States, there's a tendency to think of that it's one thing. That's monolithic, okay,
right.
That everyone in Israel agrees. And yet there can be more debate in Israel about the policies of that country than there is allowed in America about those policies. In other words,
totally right.
if you're raising issues about the behavior of Israel as a state actor, you know, as a military force, as a factor in international relations, You're accused often of being anti-Semitic or being a self-hating Jew if you're Jewish, et cetera, et cetera. The whole goal is to silence discussion.
Yes, well, I've been ostracized, and Tikkun magazine has been ostracized in the Jewish world for this very reason. And, in fact, my house has been attacked 4 times in the last year and a half by right-wing Zionists who have pasted all over the outside of my house posters saying that I'm an anti-Semite, that I'm a self-hating Jew, that I'm a Nazi, even though I actually am a big supporter of Israel and believe that Israel must be strong, but the only way it can be strong is by being generous towards the Palestinian people and helping to create a fair and a viable Palestinian state that can live in peace with Israel.
What do you say to the people who ask this question? They say, look, American Jews, 6% maybe of the population. Israel gets a disproportionately large share of American foreign aid, even though Israel is a developed country as opposed to an undeveloped country. Gets more money relatively than underdeveloped countries that really have needs, about economic survival. Israel, which is doing very well on many indicators, nevertheless gets subsidized by the U.S. kind of U.S. socialism for Israeli policies, not only military, but all on every level whatsoever, and that the Israeli lobby and lobbying force, AIPAC, etc., have a disproportionate influence, in the Congress in terms of putting forth a right-wing agenda, which is really labeled a right-wing agenda.
Yes, well, I think all that is true, and that the only mistake that is sometimes made is to say, and that's because of the Jewish people, because in fact the major element, the most powerful element in the Israel lobby is the Christian Zionists, who are if one's to believe the estimations of their leadership, there are now 30 million Christian Zionists in the United States, and they exist in many of these areas where there are very few Jews and Jewish vote is irrelevant. But the hardcore of support that makes it impossible for those who have a rational attitude towards Israel and want Israel to be strong but realize that Israel's policies are undermining its potential strength, they can't get a hold in the Congress, because you've got on the one hand the Jewish section of that, the American Israel Political Action Committee, Political Affairs Committee, AIPAC, but on the other hand, you've got this 6 times as many Christian Zionists who believe that Israel is part of their world, of their religious belief system, that Israel has to be strong. And again, I'm for a strong Israel, but they think that the way to be strong is through power, whereas I know that the way for Israel to be strong is through generosity and caring for the Palestinian people and caring for all the other people.
Maybe a moral example might be a preferable, outcome and policy. Rabbi Lerner, can you stay with us for a few minutes? This
sure.
is just cooking up here. I think it's really going great, and I'm really glad that you're here to raise these issues. We have to do some business. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, .com, PRN.FM.
We know that your life is hard. So please put down your guard. We'll send you a gift to give you a lift, a shiny new credit card. Don't fret if your funds are low. You can use it wherever you go. Whenever you do, your debts will accrue and give us a happy glow. It's so fantastic. Fantastic.
To Chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A.
American Express and Visa.
And that, my friends, is the anthem of my film, In Debt We Trust. Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. I just got to read this. I'm sorry, Michael. I have to interject with a humorous note here from The Onion. Headline, UN acquires nuclear weapon. The United Nations, a highly organized governing body bent on world peace, has obtained a nuclear warhead and intends to use the device to pursue a human rights agenda. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a short and brazen list of demands, calling on all nations to bow down at once to social progress, tremble before the awesome might of this cooperative assembly of appointed representatives, he said. At last, when the United Nations calls for the development of more sustainable agriculture practices, the world at large will listen. Is that what it's going to take? An armed threat. You know, of course, The Onion is making fun here, but it gets at part of this whole idea of, you know, how the powerful are able to try to set the agenda and impose their will. And I think part of what's the story with the Israel-Palestine issue is an incredible amount of bullying and intimidation, not only internally with police forces, occupations, and all the rest of it, and arrogance in international affairs. Here's this guy in Germany, Nobel Prize laureate Günter Grass, writes a poem criticizing Israel. And now Israel has banned him from coming to Israel. You know, retaliation. We can't allow a critical view to come to Israel. I mean, this seems like, you know, an effort to just chill all discussion and all debate.
Yeah. Well, actually, though, it's, as you mentioned before, Israel has a lot for your debate on these issues than the United States does. And it's very hard to get a conversation going in the United States. When I met with various congresspeople, when Tikkun brought hundreds and hundreds of people to lobby for a different approach to the Middle East, many of them told me that privately that they were terrified of the Israel lobby, and that they, even though they agreed with me completely on the substance, they were not going to say anything publicly because they were afraid for their own political futures.
Let's just explain how that works. In other words, let's say you're a congressman learner from the People's Republic of Berkeley, okay?
Yeah.
And
right.
you're about to run for re-election, as you would have to do every 2 years.
Right.
All of a sudden,
I have to raise money.
All of a sudden, somebody is put in the race to run against you in a primary funded by AIPAC or AIPAC's friends in effort to try to kill your candidacy. So you're living under threat.
Yes, and often those challenges can work because they are so well funded. And you see, here's the thing for about the Israel-Palestine issue. For a small group of people, both Christian Zionists and right-wing Jews, Israel is the number one issue and on which they will determine how they vote. Now, for the progressives, liberals or progressives, Israel is like the 10th down in a number of issues that they care about. So if the congressperson is going to – I mean, this was explained to me by a congressman I'm not going to cite, but from a very decent, very good progressive guy who said to me, look, Michael, in my district, there are people who, the liberals, the progressives, are not going to vote against me if I'm, I agree with them on nine of the other issues and I go along with AIPAC on the 10th issue. But there's a significant core of people in my district who are liberal on other issues, but they will not vote for me if I don't go along with AIPAC on those issues. So it's crazy for me to lose that segment of my potential base. I'm in a district where Republicans anyway have a chance of winning. Why should I lose that potential base and hence lose my seat in Congress for the sake of standing up on the Israel issue when basically the liberals and progressives don't care that much about it?
I have one last question, Michael. Yeah. We're running out of time here on this conversation,
okay,
but I wanted to keep you on because I felt you were raising so many important points. Tell us again who this guy Adelson is. You know, the guy that funded with millions of dollars the Gingrich campaign and has been funding Gingrich.
He's a right-wing Jew who's playing a terrible and destructive role. But the answer to these people is for us to build an alternative, because if we want to change, as I've argued and I argue again in my book, Embracing Israel-Palestine, the key is to change consciousness. And for changing consciousness, no, we don't need a military, and we don't need even billions of dollars. If you look at the fantastic transformations of consciousness that took place in this country through the women's movement, through the civil rights and black liberation movement, through the LGBTQ movement, these movements did not have huge amounts of money, but they had a clear vision of what they wanted, and they pushed for it. We need to have a liberal and progressive force that is willing to talk about love, kindness, generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, and awe and wonder at the grandeur of the universe. If they do, and that's what the Network of Spiritual Progressives is about, spiritualprogressives.org, we can change the discourse in this country.
Okay, Rabbi Michael Lerner. Michael Lerner, I hate to do this to you, you know?
Okay.
You know, if a Jew cuts off a rabbi while he's speaking, you know, I can get a pus wart on my nose. You know, I have to be very careful about this. But thank you so much for being with
thank
us.
Thank you, Michael Lerner.
And we just come moving on here. We have a short window to give you some updates on Occupy. Joining us is Michael Levitin, the editor of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And Michael, is Occupy the kind of community that Rabbi Lerner is talking about?
Hi there. Yeah, I only got in on sort of the last part of that conversation. I would have things to dispute on that line. I feel like his end point, that liberals and progressives are the ones who need to spread this message, I think Occupy goes quite in contrast to that idea, because liberals and progressives have been spreading that message of kindness and of a more holistic view of the world. They've been doing that for decades. And that message, through the political process and through petitioning and electing, is precisely the thing that did not work, even after electing Obama, and hence Occupy is quite different in a sense from that. However, we're seeing a new stage evolving in Occupy, and I think that's clear in these last several weeks, and will become even more clear. So other points of learning.
What is that stage? Where are we going in Occupy? I mean, Catherine is you know, in the studio. She's been an occupier. I've been involved with Occupy Wall Street. I wrote a book called Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street. I've been a journalistic and media booster of Occupy. What is your sense of where the movement is headed?
My sense at the moment is that this idea that more the communities in themselves are picking up the ball now. They already started to do that in the fall. The eruption that Occupy produced in a sense of hope and new kind of transformative coming together of communities and the ability to come out and meet one another and participate and discuss these issues, that was opened up by Occupy. But what we're seeing now, I think, in part helped by this 99% spring idea that really isn't an Occupy initiative. It's really more from the progressive liberal side of you know, constituents and voting blocks. I think that bringing people out, not Occupy per se, but actually out to talk about the issues that Occupy has raised, is a quite smart and probably a really strategic way to move forward, and I think Occupy would be smart to pick up on that energy. I know that there are elements of resistance to that because it is not precisely in line with the Occupy utter grassroots sort of and consensus-based foundation that Occupy was built on, but I think that they're going to have to join forces.
The horizontalist, ideas. But I was very concerned by this Adbuster statement issued yesterday calling for a fight to the finish by, people in Occupy against, people who might be organized differently. I would assume, that they referenced Move On and Ben and Jerry, as if Ben putting them in the same boat as the cops and the media. But they didn't sort of mention the unions, which are also, of course, been supporting Occupy and are very structured and have leaders and the like. Is this contradiction, is this conflict going to actually tear us apart?
I don't think so. I think that a movement like this has such radical roots at its foundation, at its forming, the basic principle of occupying. I think you need to keep that true, hard, uncompromising side alive. And I think that's obviously what Adbusters and many in Occupy are doing. I don't see it. I think that it's a natural evolution that this movement was started for the very purpose, in a sense, of galvanizing and mobilizing what we're now, only 6 months later, starting to see in reality, which is tens of thousands of people who were not involved, and hopefully hundreds of thousands, and let's call it millions within a certain period of time.
But what I'm responding to, Michael, really is a kind of the fear of co-optation. Calvin, can't wait. Just wait 1 second. I'm going to let you speak. I'm kidding. The idea of co-optation. It's somehow
that's very real.
I understand, but somehow that this movement can be co-opted so easily. I don't believe that. I don't believe that, the people who have been fighting in the streets and been arrested, beaten, thrown in jail and are struggling together, can so easily be swayed, by a Move On online petition or a dollar from Ben and Jerry's or an ice cream cone. I don't think that that's going to happen.
They're not worried about being swayed themselves. I don't think that's the worry. They are worried that the fundamental principles, which is for transformative change in this country, transformative, not ameliorative, not a Band-Aid and not legislation that merely, does away with Citizens United and says, all right, clean our hands and that was a great first step. No, this is actually like a movement for sweeping change that profoundly alters the landscape of how politics, economics, finance, environment, how we look at all these things. I think that the concern, which is legitimate in a sense, is that unions, progressive groups, groups that are much more already allied with the Democratic Party and with the establishment, by nature of them working with the establishment, that they would, yes, that there will be positive change that they can absolutely push hard for now, but they could also stop short. Were they to achieve aims that served unions and aims that served progressive groups, how much more urgency will they feel to actually go the next step.
Okay, Catherine has the last question here. We have just a few minutes.
Hey, Michael, I met you the other day. Can you just talk a little bit about, the action that I met you at just a couple of days ago?
The Bank of America action, yeah.
Yeah.
I was really impressed, and I was very kind of enthusiastic and hopeful seeing many people, really, who haven't been in Occupy. These are older, these are elderly people, these are people of all colors, and you have students there,
and who put it on? Who was the organizer again?
I believe in the Lower East Side, a long-term organizing group in the Lower East Side, and that I turned out for just out of curiosity. I wanted to see what sort of organizing they were going to do, and to pull a direct action, and to go outside of Bank of America and actually make some noise for a good 45 minutes or an hour and allow the public to see that nothing is forgotten. We aren't being quiet. This is not Occupy. This is people coming out and voicing opposition to a bank that is defrauded and committed the most criminal acts, really, of any financial institution in the country, the most among many.
Michael, I'm sorry to cut you up here a little bit. I'm so happy that you could join us. We're really great fans of your work at Occupied Wall Street Journal. It's been really playing a major role in explaining the issues and really giving the movement a sense sense of its own media, which is so important. So thank you for coming on.
We'll have another edition, the spring edition, out in about a week.
And I hope that we'll have you back here on News Dissector Radio. Thank you, Catherine. Okay, thank you. If you want to reach us about the show, any comments, any thoughts, any suggestions, you can write to dissector@mediachannel.org, dissector@mediachannel.org. I write the News Dissector blog at newsdissector.net every single day. Today I have a discussion about this whole Adbusters issue. I'd love to get your reaction to it, your comments on it as well. We'll be back again next week, same time, same station. Thank you, Matt, for your work. Thank you, Catherine, for being here today at 3 o'clock at 56 Walker Street. The Anarchist Film Festival resumes. Check it out if you can. I'm Danny Schechter. See you next week.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold.
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops.